You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We turn now to our series, Minding Michigan, focusing on mental health and wellness. When do you know the time has come to seek mental health care? And where do you go? To whom do you turn? These are critical questions in the quest for mental health and wellness, and we don't tend to think about them until there's a crisis. So let's explore these questions as we welcome Michigan State University psychiatrist, Dr. Farha Abbasi. Dr. Abbasi, welcome back.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Good to have you with us. And we welcome back clinical psychologist and director of Monarch Behavioral Health in Bloomfield Hills, Dr. Julie Brakaszewski. Your patients all call you Dr. Julie, so we will too. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start right with that first question. When do we know the time has come to seek mental health care first for ourselves? What do you think, Dr. Abbasi?
The most important thing is safety. So we have to be very sure that someone who's struggling is not having thoughts of hurting themselves or hurting anyone else. So safety becomes the most important criteria. But the other things that we explore is the severity then. What symptoms you are having, how severe the symptoms are. Let's say you're feeling sad. Is it mild depression, moderate or severe? Then comes the most important factor that kind of decides when to seek treatment is also functionality. So if you are depressed, you are having these severe symptoms, thoughts of hurting yourself or hurting someone else, how is it impacting your life? Is it impacting your schoolwork, your relationships, your everyday communication? So functionality is also becomes very important to navigate how and when to seek care.
We often also, to that same point, we often look at individuals' change, both for adults and children, but a little differently. Mm-hmm. And that what has changed recently? Is their personality changing? Is it different when you're interacting with them? Is their ability to handle the daily hassles of life when the grocery cart hits your car, when somebody's late? Are you just not, has it changed that you're just not able to cope with that stress anymore? Mm-hmm. And for kids, it's a little different in that they're developing, and they're developing over childhood and adolescence, and the definition of development is change. So it is really hard for parents and other loved ones to understand when a kid is just in a phase and when it's not a phase.
And as a parent, I know you just think you know where they're at and they go move because it's always a moving goalpost.
Absolutely.
When your kids are developing.
Absolutely.
And I know, Dr. Julie, your caseload is about 65% child and about 35% adult. So where should that point of seeking care for a child be?
Absolutely. So we know when a kid hits a developmental milestone, they're just about to hit that milestone, they fall apart completely. And it's maddening as a parent. You see a regression in toileting, sometimes tantruming. All of a sudden, they can't do their math homework. What is going on here? If it lasts for more than just a couple days to a couple weeks, time to seek help. It is not a phase.
Okay. Well, that's a good way to just to kind of wrap your mind around that. Dr. Abbasi, do you find that patients, people, wait too long before they become patients, that problems are more deeply rooted than if they had come to you sooner?
Definitely. I think when it comes to mental health, we still have a lot of stigma, a lot of misinformation. So we see a lot of denial that comes in, that this is not this. This is, like you said, it can be a phase, or he hasn't eaten, or the school is hard, or, you know, the first thing we always tell the kids or the youth is, toughen up, we had it harder than you guys, you know. So there's a lot of denial initially. So I always talk about the person themselves should be able to accept that they are struggling with, be it depression or anxiety, and then somebody validating it for them. Or it could be a parent, it could be a friend, it could be a colleague, somebody kind of saying that, yes, you are acting different, you are functioning different. So that becomes very important. But definitely there's denial and very defensiveness around it.
When you think of denial, when you say that the person recognizes, let's talk about adults first, and then we'll talk about teenagers and kids. But let's say that a partner sees a change, but the other person does not buy into it, is not accepting that. What do you do then?
There are shared common goals in every life and relationship. There is usually some type of goal orientation that an individual who is distressed or has a mental health issue, they're not meeting that goal. And that's discrepant from the life that they want to live, or they know they are not living out their potential. And so you tap into that. You know, what do you want out of life? And what is getting in the way? Do you want help with that, with overcoming that. Here are the strategies. And then sometimes you also get a buy-in with being really specific about what you're going to do in therapy.
Okay.
We're not just going to come in and chat for a while and then you leave, reduce the ambiguity, and have a treatment plan, get buy-in for a specific amount of sessions, and also create accountability when you leave the therapy room. What are we expecting you're going to try out and do so that they can see the change working in their lives and buy in at least to a certain degree?
I would also like to add that one thing is not having the knowledge or information, but there is also knowing a little and creating a perjury term around it. So especially when partners are referring, it shouldn't be like, oh, you are acting so bipolar. You are so borderline. I think people listen and hear these words on media, in TV shows, magazines, but they don't really understand what it means. So when you are trying to bring a family member or a kid to the treatment, you don't say, you are acting crazy, you are acting bipolar. You know, that's something I always talk to parents, and especially, you know, in couples, if you are referring your husband, wife, or a partner, you have to be very respectful and thoughtful of the way you are using these terms.
So give us some phrases. Let's play act a little bit. What would you say to me if I'm a parent of a resistant teenager that just doesn't want anything to do with going to therapy, but I'm making that kid come?
The most important thing is assuring them of your love for them, validating their struggle. Other thing is the kids would say, think like, oh, you want me to go to college or you want me to do this. It becomes our goals that we want the kids to be like this trophy or you are not doing well in school. It shouldn't come out like, oh, your classes are getting affected. It should be, I'm invested in you. I'm concerned about you. I'm worried about you. So once the kids are validated and heard and listened to, the rapport has to be, the trust has to be established.
Absolutely. Coming from that foundation of love and care. And as parents, we often get tripped up in the distress that we're feeling as parents. We feel really anxious. Our child is suffering. So it feels dangerous or scary. And then that emotional experience informs our communication. And then we clamp down. And instead, in those moments, it's very effective to think, how much do I love my child? What do they want to get out of life? Are they not performing? Mm-hmm. Are they crying on the sidelines every game? Are they coming home in tears when it comes down to tests? Is that what's going on? Well, they don't want to be experiencing that. So coming from that foundation of love, absolutely, and validating with empathic words rather than labeling words.
Right.
I see those tests are hard for you. Let's make them easier. I see, oh, man, when that coach is yelling from the sidelines, you take it to heart because you care so much. I wonder if there's ways we can deal with that to make it so it's not so distressing. Yeah. And do a lot of that wondering. I wonder if somebody can help us with this so that you feel like you are a team with your child rather than pushing them. It's not your goal. It is their goal. But you are facilitating it because you love them so much.
And it sounds like you can take everything that you've both said without much difficulty and adapt that for our adult relationships.
Absolutely.
As well. Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, we are talking about when you know the time has come to seek mental health care and where you go, as we talk with clinical psychologist Dr. Julie Brakaszewski, director of the Monarch Behavioral Health in Bloomfield Hills, and Michigan State University psychiatrist Dr. Farah Abbasi. So this is a great chance for me to ask this question. We're going to do a little compare and contrast because before me is an MD psychiatrist and a PhD clinical psychologist. So Dr. Abbasi, what can a psychologist like Dr. Julie offer to patients?
I'm a big proponent of prescribing and combining it with therapy. The clinical psychologist or therapist play an immensely important role because they are the ones who sustain this person day in, day out, weekly basis, while the psychiatrist then follow up monthly or maybe twice a month, something like that.
Okay. And so, Dr. Julie, how do you fit a psychiatrist into what kind of care plan you might design?
It's incredibly important to be teamed up with a psychiatrist that you trust and know and have that working relationship with. You know, we do see individuals who do not need medication, but many do. And being able to refer out is extremely important for the medical treatment. Emotions, mood, some behaviors are very neurobiological basis. So when an individual is coming in and engaging in their treatment protocol and they're doing the skill building and understanding their thinking patterns, emotional patterns, but they're not making progress, they may need a foundation of neurobiological help to springboard and use all of those skills that they're working so hard to develop. They may need a little bit of help. I think it's also useful to take a step back and think about the different training and training style, because so often, at least 20 times a week, we get calls at our office for a psychiatrist. We want to talk to Dr. Julie, the psychiatrist, and I have to back away and say, oh, that's not what I do. I do not prescribe. If you come in, we can do a diagnostic evaluation, and we can absolutely work on a diagnosis. We can do testing and psychoevaluation, and we can do treatment, but I do not prescribe. A psychiatrist goes to medical school and specializes in psychiatry.
So let's say I realize that I do need to see a mental health professional. What do I do to find the right one?
I think we all are an entry point.
Absolutely.
So somebody can be referred to a psychiatrist initially or a clinical psychologist.
Well, let's say I look up a clinic. I'm surfing on the web because I've decided I need to go. I pick a name. I wait for an appointment. I finally get there. And then I get the feeling that this therapist and I are not going to click. Do either of you offer prospective patients a chance for a get acquainted meeting, or dare I say a test drive?
Absolutely. And many clinicians do. It has to be limited in nature just because of, quite honestly, the legalities of understanding what treatment is and signing kind of information, protected information documents. And oftentimes that is involved in a full intake evaluation. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, most clinicians will meet with people for small intervals and especially have phone conversations so you can get a chance to understand their personality and communication style. And during our intakes, we really stress that clinician match is very important. If I remind you of your hated Aunt Hilga, you are not going to do well in therapy with me. And that is totally fine. We have a lot of colleagues we can refer to. So if my communication style or personality just doesn't hit the mark, that is fine.
Yeah, I'm sure that's got to be very important. And then how do you know when you're done?
I think for me personally, as a psychiatrist, we have a very fast turnover. Mm-hmm. We have to keep that in mind. And the basic thing that we are looking at is, are you stable on your meds? So initially, the medication doses might be higher. You might be using a combination of meds. But then as you start to function better, the goal is to bring you down to the lowest effective level, maintenance doses. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, functionality, but also having that insight of, let's say somebody is suffering from bipolar. Mm-hmm. Are they aware what to look for, what red flags to look for, when to see that they are going through a relapse, when they are getting hypomanic? So all those insight and safety, again.
Sure.
Absolutely. And in the therapeutic context, hopefully you have a set of goals. When those goals are met, as much as I enjoy seeing the individuals that I work with, I am exuberant when I don't see them anymore. Or right. I run into them at the grocery store and I haven't seen them in 3 months, and it's because they're doing wonderfully. When you've met your goals, you're done. Some people do need maintenance therapy.
Yeah, to continue for a tune-up.
Absolutely. And continue to, am I using the skills in the way that I intend to? Am I keeping up with my goals? And sometimes we'll drop down to even just once a month. Right. Once, bi-monthly to do the check-in of that functioning. So we know, do we need to refer back to your psychiatrist? Do you need a change in meds? What is going on here? Do you need thyroid testing? Let's go back to your PCP, your primary care physician, which is also a great entry point.
Entry point, right.
Yeah.
Very much so.
So you're done when you meet your goals, but we say goodbye with an open door.
Okay. Right. The word stigma, we always wind up using that word when we talk about mental health and wellness. So how do you destigmatize that process of therapy for that patient who perhaps is reluctant to come to see you or doesn't want people to know that they're coming to see Dr. Julie or Dr. Abbasi? How do you destigmatize it?
There are lots of different levels. And one is with the individual to try and get a sense of, where is their stigmatization coming from? Is it very personal? Are they experiencing a lot of guilt and shame? Is it familial? Is it cultural? Is it more at the society level? And try to speak to that hot button, that kind of, if you think of like an underground river that's flowing, where is that coming from for them? and then address that issue. And you can use, like you were speaking earlier about important language, not using diagnoses as labels for people.
Right.
Also, mental health issues are normal. Everyone experiences them throughout their life. In the past year, over 20% of individuals have experienced a major mental health illness.
Right.
But only just below half of those individuals will get treatment.
Care.
And then children and adolescents, it's only about 76%, I think, they don't get treatment. 76% of children and adolescents with mental health needs do not get treatment.
And I think how I look at it is whenever we have secrecy about something, secrecy leads to shame, shame leads to stigma. And one other thing, important thing to understand is that we have to promote the disease model with the mental illness, that it is a biopsychosocial struggle. It is like any other disease out there. So you are not ashamed when you get the diagnosis of diabetes. You are worried, you are anxious, but you are not ashamed of being called diabetic. It becomes harder when you're saying you are depressed or you are bipolar. So I think we have to be able to have conversations like this, create more awareness, and give it more visibility.
And if I can piggyback on the diabetes parallel, we often use that in our office,
right,
that medical model, in that, you know, there's a spectrum of, you know, type 1, type 2, how the body is functioning. But no matter the spectrum of diabetes that you are diagnosed with, there has to be behavioral change as well as often emotional change. You have to keep your stress low. So that is a great medical correlate to mental health issues, that when you're speaking with loved ones, you can use that and say, would you tell somebody to not go to a doctor and to not use insulin when they have diabetes?
Right.
Well, that wouldn't be fair. You need both. You need the complementary, the medical perspective, as well as the behavioral and the emotional perspective on that.
Well, it has been wonderful getting insights from both of you. We've been talking with Dr. Julie Brakaczewski, who's clinical psychologist and director of Monarch Behavioral Health in Bloomfield Hills. Dr. Julie, thank you so much. And Michigan State University psychiatrist, Dr. Farah Abbasi, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Special thanks for continuing this conversation.